On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour
with Virginia Trioli.
Great to have your company this Thursday morning. There seems to be a lid on much of Melbourne and broader metropolitan areas and into the state as well, a lid of cloud that keeps things looking rather dull and cool as we head into an unusually mild Christmas season. But it's going to get pretty warm here because you have some fantastic guests joining you in just a moment. Leah Purcell has turned her award-winning play, The Drover's Wife, into a thrilling novel. The legend of Molly Johnson, as originally seen and created by Henry Lawson in his classic The Drover's Wife. Molly Johnson's tale in The Drover's Wife under the Leah Purcell eye becomes this amazing Australian Western. And she's going to be joining you in just a moment. But before we get to her, been talking matters medical this morning, I'm delighted to see again Dr. Ranjana Srivastava, who I've not seen in ages, oncologist, author, broadcaster, Guardian columnist, Fulbright scholar. Oh, stop. That's enough. Overachiever, all up. Now, come nice on. To see you.
It's lovely to see you.
We used to have fun on Breakfast News together.
That's right. That's right. And then I just couldn't do the early hours like you did, although you're still doing
stop
them.
Stop it, you big whinger. We got you in at 7 a.m. That means you didn't have to get up till 5. That's not early. That's what we call a lie-in.
That's a late shift for you.
That's a late shift, exactly right. You've been busy.
Yeah, just like everyone else, I think, just doing different things, yeah.
Your book, your most recent book, A Better Death, Conversations About the Art of Living and Dying Well. Love the idea of it, an essential idea that we need to talk about. We'll get to that in a moment, but can we continue our conversation, as we have this morning with listeners, about the overworking of young doctors? More figures, more stats showing this is going on. Seriously, how old is this conversation? You tell us. As someone who's worked in hospitals, who is a doctor, who did your early training yourself, why does it go on?
First of all, I'll say that the problem isn't just limited to young doctors. It's actually across the board. And I will share this story, which is partly a little bit embarrassing, but your producer rang me about an hour ago to make sure that I was on my way. And I was on my way, and I'd pulled over, parked, and I was actually taking a nap for 20 minutes because I was so tired. It's just exhausting. And I think to myself, is this a first world problem that I'm tired at 10 o'clock in the morning? Is it the... But I think, you know, when I reflect, it's both the physical and emotional toil of looking after patients day after day. And I think junior doctors obviously have it much tougher because they work full-time, long hours, on-call, disrupted sleep, all of that which many older doctors like me are somewhat protected from now. But it really is a problem that is kind of recognized but under-recognized.
Well, recognized, yes, you're quite right, because, you know, as I say, we have this story almost every year. The figures come out and we have an identical conversation year on year. So everyone's overworked, and you know, people listening will agree with that and say, yes, in their job, which might not be medical, they feel overworked as well. But isn't there something particularly cultural to the way that the medical profession likes to see its junior doctors trained?
I think certainly when I was growing up, I wouldn't say I hear about it less anymore, but I do think there is a certain track of thought that says if you don't put in as many hours as your predecessors did, yeah, and if you don't suffer in the same way as other people did, this whole talk about in my time we did this, then you may not become as good a doctor. And I don't think there is a lot of evidence for it. And on the contrary, if you are tired, then it's like having a high blood alcohol level in terms of the errors we make,
yeah,
and the misjudgments we make. But I do think, Virginia, that the things are changing, and they're changing slowly, but they are changing in terms of mandatory hours and many days on which I go into work, and I hear that the trainee has a day off in preparation for working on the weekend. Now, I'm absolutely not saying that that's adequate, but it's something you wouldn't have heard about a few years ago. But I feel very concerned for the well-being of our junior doctors, because I do think that overwork is a real issue. And I think it is different in medicine, probably because we hold the lives of patients in our hands.
Interesting observation here. We've just received a call from a nurse who says, Ranjana, that she believes the doctor shortage is due to the lack of students that the medical field takes in. Are hospitals and teaching hospitals taking in a smaller cohort of medical students compared to previous years?
That's not to my knowledge. If anything, I find that numbers are expanding, but so is the need. I think we have become a 24/7. There used to be a lull. After the peak of winter, there used to be a lull in the hospital system up until, say, maybe 7 to 10 years ago, which we used to look forward to. You sort of get through the winter and then you get a chance to relax. Now there is no lull. It's full on all the time, including Christmas, New Year, and all the rest of it. And that's just a symptom of an aging population.
Is there an appetite to change this? Do you think anyone, that the administrators of the hospitals, the doctors themselves, maybe even the junior doctors coming into a system that they're dying to get into, any genuine appetite to try and change that culture of overwork?
I think there is an appetite to change it, but if I may be so provocative, I think that institutions and organizations in general rely on the goodwill of doctors to keep working and not to protest. And I see this all the time where you don't just clock off if you have a sick patient. Of course you stay, and then you think about whether or not to put it on your timesheet or not, and sometimes it's all too hard or whatever. But it's not, medicine is not a clock on, clock off job. And I think people understand very well, people in decision-making places, that regardless of conditions, regardless of sometimes, I think, concern about personal well-being, doctors will stay and they will work.
Let's talk about your most recent book. It was published in June of this year, I think, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yes. A Better Death, Conversations About the Art of Living and Dying Well. What sparked the reason to write that book?
Well, I think sort of, 20 years of being a clinician and observing people, especially as an oncologist, and how people live and how people die. And I think this realization, and I'd be the first to say I'm no sage or font of wisdom, but I do think that I can be a conduit for the experiences that I see all around me. And what struck me is how people die has so much to do with how they have lived and whether they have contemplated a legacy, their mortality, and so on. So although the title may be confronting, I would say that, half the book is about living well, not necessarily just dying well.
I'm so glad you said that. I was lucky enough to attend IMC, the Palliative Care Conference, a year or so ago, and it went for 2 or 3 days. Some of the most amazing experiences of my life were had at that palliative care conference.
Wow.
And there was a palliative care expert who came out from Canada who made just that point, Ranjana. And he said, your dying has already started. It started now. It started and it continues with how you choose to live your life right now. Because as you say, you will die as you live. And if you're someone who's confronted the issues of your life, that will inform your dying. If you're someone who's fled from the challenges of your life, that will inform your dying. And on and on and on. If you're combative, if you're at peace, if you're anxious, that will inform your death. He said it's not set in stone. You can change that right now. But it was a wonderful call to action about, this is not a dress rehearsal, folks. This is it. The clock's running. How do you want the rest of your days to be?
Yeah, and I think in a very transactional society, it's very difficult for us to think about dying and about the ultimate finality of our death. But time and again, I see things like people who are generous and who are forgiving and who have a broader sense of self, perhaps, or even a deep sense of knowing who they are inside. So while the world is telling them to do certain things at the end of life, or there are pulls and pushes, there is almost this inner sanctum where they are very comfortable and confident about what they know they need to do to make their life meaningful. And it's really inspiring to be in the midst of it. And so I've had this book in my mind for a number of years, and I thought, well, someone should tell all the other people about the admirable things that I see.
What's that moment like when you have to tell someone that their cancer is untreatable or has advanced so far that they are now in their last days?
I get asked that quite a bit. And you know, I like to say, and many people ask as a consequence of that, does it become easier? And I reflect on this a lot. And I would say that it's always difficult, and it always should be difficult. I think, you know, your pulse quickens and your throat dries a bit, because you are the holder of information that is fundamentally going to change someone's life, the lives of their loved ones. And I think there shouldn't be any complacency attached to it. And it should be difficult, and it is difficult, especially, I would say, around this time of the year.
Are there ever reasons in your mind to fudge that slightly?
Fudging or being gentle, I think, is different from telling a lie.
I don't mean telling a lie. So, but I do mean deliberately softening that blow by perhaps withholding a tiny bit of information that won't make any difference anyway, but you just know that person, for whatever reason, is going to cope better if you fudge it.
And I think that is the art of medicine, isn't it? About learning to know your patient and understanding what it is that will help someone, how to hold out hope without, you know, how not to extinguish hope, but also not lie. And you know, I'm commonly, in fact, every year there are people who will say, why don't you just tell mom she has an ulcer? Why don't you just tell dad he has an infection? And somewhere you have to draw the line, the ethical line, to say, no, I can't do that. However, not everyone has to know all the minute details of their illness if they don't choose to. And I guess how I have tried to navigate this is often by asking patients, how much would you like to know? And when would you like to know? What would you like to know? Because it doesn't have to be just one conversation. And one of the, I think, beauties of doing oncology and knowing patients on the longer term is these conversations can ebb and flow.
Lovely text message here, Ranjana, from Simon. My mum is 86 with advanced Alzheimer's. We, her children, have power of her care. She always insisted on dying as naturally as possible. We are discussing with her medical staff the withholding of any life-extending treatment, such as antibiotics, etc., just ensure comfort and no pain. It's very confronting, but it's what she would want.
And it's
tricky.
It is, but it's also so heartening to see that the family is ultimately respecting somebody's wish and having these conversations, which will hopefully make her end-of-life care easier and also the experience of going through this for the family.
The other life-changing moment at that palliative care conference was the suggestion that we all leave and have what's called death over dinner, which is we all come together as either a friendship group or a family group with the person who is older or dying or facing this, and have lovely food and great wine and have a proper, open, loving conversation about how would you like your last days to be? What can we do? How can we help?
Mm. Wow. I wonder how many people take up that offer and do it. But you remind me of someone who said at a conference once that with Christmas coming up, every Christmas the whole family gets around the table and the first conversation they have is, right, what's your end-of-life wish? Let's get it over with. And then they have lunch.
Should be doing that at Easter rather than Christmas. That's more appropriately there. The death, not the birth. Ranjana Srivastava is with you, oncologist, author, broadcaster, and she's written that book, A Better Death, Conversations About the Art of Living and Dying Well. Coming up next, Leah Purcell, actor, writer, film and theatre maker, and now novelist. She's turned her celebrating and award-winning play, The Drover's Wife, into The Drover's Wife, the novel, The Legend of Molly Johnson. And she joins me and Dr. Ranjana Srivastava now. Leah, good morning.
Good morning, ladies.
It's great to have your company here this morning. I've been a huge fan of your work for so many years.
Oh, thank you.
I want to get to talk about the movies as well later on. But this is, well, this is smart. Girlfriend. Three for one.
That's it.
Movie, play, and novel out of the same. Very clever. It's cost efficient.
Yes, it is. Look, we've done that with a few of our projects, you know, milk it for all it's worth. if like the play worked and we're onto something, yeah. Let's go. But it's a great story. I've had it with me for ages because my mum would read it to me as a little girl.
Oh, and, really?
Yeah, so she had a book of Henry Lawson's published short stories. And unfortunately, she passed away before I was at the age where I could say, Mum, why Henry Lawson? Yeah. Where did you get this book from? And she'd recite it and read it to me because I was a mongrel sleeper as a kid. And I always go, tell me that story. So it'd be midnight and she's, you know, reciting it, falling asleep, and I'd stop her at the end and say the famous last line of, Ma, I won't never go a-droving. And she'd say, now go to bloody sleep. But I sort of saw myself and my mother, she was the drover's wife. I was Jack, as Henry Lawson calls the older boy in his version, because it was just me and my mum at home, and we had a wood heap and we split logs and we'd, you know, boil the water in the copper pot. And so, I've had it with me for a very long time. And then I was a director at a workshop for writers and I was very frustrated with them. So I said, maybe it's time for me to write my next big thing. And I went home and pulled the little book out. I didn't reread it. I sat it beside my computer and just tried to remember the story, how my mother told it. And away I went, and they say the rest is history.
Leah, what's remarkable is that The Drover's Wife was written by Henry Lawson back in 1892.
Mm. Yep.
And it has had many reimaginings, hasn't it? A few people have written about
many.
It. So what is it about this book that still captures the imagination that in 2020 we still have a movie coming out about it that you're making? You've just written a book. Tell us
why. I know a lot of people say, it was read to me as a kid, and I should ask them why. But it is something that just resonates. Like when I was thinking about the idea, there was a play on about Henry Lawson and Banjo Patterson, and Max Cullen was in it. I can't think of the other actor's name, but when they mentioned The Drover's Wife, the whole auditorium just sighed with this, this knowing, this love for this story. I don't know whether it's because everyone can relate to it because their mothers have had to show that type of strength or live under some sort of similar conditions, but it has. It's captured the heart of Australians back then, and there's a new resurgence in school where they are teaching that. I had a lot of young people come through the play, 16-year-olds that are learning it in high school, and then you've got your loyal fans that are 80 plus that could get to the theatre and they'd be there. So I can only put it down to a mother's love, you know, which I wanted to capitalise on in the interpretation of my story, that everyone, you know, you've either had it or you've missed out on it, and it's something that's really important to everyone.
That's very true.
Yeah
and you're right, even in the difference of experience, that's a connecting experience.
Yes.
Absence and presence in that respect is almost the same thing because they're both as powerful.
Yes. Yeah.
What's changed a great deal in the three incarnations that we're talking about? I know that filming has wrapped about a week ago on the film version that you've directed of The Drover's Wife, your play. It'll come out in late 2020, maybe early 2021. Yeah. See how the editing process and the distribution process goes. But what have been the bigger changes in the three incarnations, or have there been any?
No, that was one of my challenges. I wanted to not just have... I wanted different audiences to come, you know, build the audience of it. So in the play, you had two acts, and I always like to leave my plays open-ended so I want my audience to walk away going, oh, what do you think happened? I don't want them to go walk away talking about coffee or where they're going next. So you are left with the suspense of it starts to snow. Well, I did it at Belvoir, it starts to snow and Molly Johnson says to her son, I'll introduce you to these two men that done me wrong when you're old enough, and the lights go out and the audience goes, oh, my goodness. But I also thought about having an interval and having third and fourth act, but I said, no, I'm going to save that for the film.
Ah, clever.
So in the film, you get the third and fourth act where Molly does go, and by chance she runs into this man that had done her wrong, and she has an opportunity to get even. And then with the novel, what was great was what I couldn't fit in the play, or what didn't make the film script, I could put into the novel. And that was exciting, because I had, when you write a film script, you've got to also write character breakdowns for your actors that come in. So I had story galore. And so then I just sort of, you know, fattened it out and fleshed it out and wove it into the rest of the book, which was really nice to be able to put everything in it and more, you know, because Penguin Random House, my editors said, can you give us a paragraph on the bit where the kids go up into the mountains? And I said, yeah, no worries. So I gave them another 10,000 words. And they said, stop, this is the second
Well,
book.
It was their mistake for asking, wasn't
That's
it?
That's right.
Yeah. They opened the door.
Yeah, they opened the door. They said, that's the second book, stop. So they had this in-house debate whether it should go in this one or save it for next one. So it's exciting.
The book starts off dramatically, and it is such a good read. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
But I think out of all of reading about you and reading your book, the thing that struck me most, and perhaps it's apt to talk about it today with all the talk about, you know, our falling educational standards and the role that teachers play in students' lives and the VCE results coming out today. You were apparently not such a good English student.
C average student.
And tell us a little bit about your English teacher and how you... You know, how you were resurrected by your teacher.
Yeah, well, I was fortunate to have two teachers that really sort of made me look at myself and turn myself around. And it was in grade 7 with the teacher, and I won a little writing competition, and it was to write a story about your neighbours. And I put it in, and I knew I'd, you know, come back with a lot of red pen because my spelling wasn't very good and my grammar wasn't very good, punctuation all over the place. And, of course, it came back and there was all this red through it, and it had "see me" down the bottom. So I said, oh, here I go. So I walked up and I apologised. I said, I'm so sorry, miss. I owe you a red pen. And she said, no, that's not what I want to see you about. And she said, this story is really good. Would you like to continue on in this competition? I said, yeah, but what about all the mistakes? And she said, I can help you with that. I can help you with that. So she said, you know, you think about it and you come, you know, you let me know tomorrow. So for the first time in 7 years of my primary school days, I was there at 8:30 with my little notepad ready to collaborate and workshop my story. And it absolutely... And then I won the Mergan Lions Rotary Club competition in the South Burnett. And, even back then I would have not dreamed in my wildest dreams of becoming a writer or, you know, and now I do it for a living. I write and read, and I ran away from it at school, you know.
And not just any writer, with a swathe of awards, you know, really impressive stuff.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you.
But the most perfect moral from that story, I love a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a moral. One teacher.
Yeah.
It just takes one teacher.
Yeah.
And it's like in all of us, in every child, there is a locked door that someone just needs to find the key to. And if you get to fling it open,
yes,
light and life and potential just rush in, and that child gets to rush out into it.
Yeah, well, it just gives you a little bit of hope. You know, I grew up with a sole parent, Aboriginal mum. You know, she was a maid. There wasn't a lot of things that you could become in Mergan. It was either you're either going to be a nurse and go away and do nursing. I've got a couple of nurses in the family, or work at the Mergan Meatworks, you know. So to have aspirations to be in the industry, everyone thought I was crazy. And then, you know, my mum only got a grade 4 education. She was an Aboriginal woman. That's all that was given. So she had to educate herself, and I should have took a leaf out of her book, but I rebelled against it. And then it was this teacher that just sort of said, you're actually good at something, kid, you know. And then, of course, you become a teenager and that goes away and you've got to sort yourself out. And then you remember what that teacher said and someone else backs it up down the track. So, you know, so with this book, I'm pretty chuffed. The little girl that used to be afraid to hand in her work is feeling pretty proud of herself.
Did you go back to the teacher? Is she still alive?
She's still alive, but no, I haven't. Oh. She's in Mergen, so I'll have to send her a copy.
You can send her a copy.
In my very first book that I wrote, I acknowledged my English teacher, who was a cranky, crusty old man in the States, who always wore a sardonic smile, and he had some sort of a stick that he would bang against the desk. He didn't hit us.
Yeah.
He would bang against the desk, and I can just picture him. And he used to say, "Put me there, put me there." And what he meant was, you need to transport me as a reader to what you are describing.
Yeah.
And I actually acknowledged it. I went and gave him a copy of my book. Where he was in his 80s by that time.
Was he pleased?
And he was thrilled. He was speechless.
That's so good.
He was absolutely thrilled that I think teachers also, especially as they get older, and he had been retired for 20 or so years by that time, they don't expect to be remembered in such a way.
No, and it's always so meaningful to them when they are.
Yeah.
Leah, I've been an admirer of your work as an actor for a long time, and I wanted to take you back to many of the great films you've done, but two in particular, because you've been so lucky to work with a director I think is one of our finest in the country, Ray Lawrence.
Absolutely, I agree
with Lantana
that.
On Lantana and on Jindabyne. Two films that I just don't think, frankly, get enough recognition and esteem for how important they are as works of cinema. But always with themes of, themes important to women and also as a black woman and a proud black woman as you are. What was that experience like working with him, and what did you learn for your future life as a director from him?
Yeah, lots, because I consider Ray my mentor. I'm due to give him a call too and say thank you. But when we did Lantana, at that stage I was sort of deep in Box the Pony world, and we were looking to even turn that into a film. And when I got the role of Lantana, he said I was one after 10, the last one of 10,000. I said, yeah, sure. But I said, it makes me feel good. But as we were going to rehearsals and driving out to set, I'd go with him and he would quiz me about how would you do this if this circumstance arose and what's your story. And it was amazing to just sit and have these and drive through the beautiful landscapes where we were and have these conversations. And as I said, you know, not one to sit still in a classroom, so to have the one-on-one with Ray Lawrence directing was pretty special. And it was great, you know, I can give him a phone call and he rings me up. And it was when we were actually doing Jindabyne up in the Snowy Mountains, and me and my partner would on the weekends go for a walk around the parks, and I just fell in love with the landscape. And I said, that was my first time up that way, and I said, we don't utilise this landscape enough in our films or our TV shows. And I said, we've got to do something here. So when we got to the top of Mount Kosciuszko, I said, right, putting it out there on country, 2006, I'm going to come back, I'm going to do something, and I think I'm going to write it, I think I'm going to be in it. It's probably going to be The Drover's Wife. And 2000, that is true.
The universe was listening.
Yeah, the universe was listening. And 2019, a week and a half ago, we finished.
The universe comes up on this conversation again and again and again about there being some, I don't know, organising spirit or some voice listening somewhere. Does that idea of spirituality play a big role in your life?
It does. I'm an observant of Hinduism,
Hindu
culture and Hinduism in general. And yes, and also, you know, in a funny way, I think spirituality plays such a big part, even in a society that is becoming less religious per se in my work. And I see evidence of it everywhere, sort of things coming back to you, people who bless you in some way, patients. I pinch myself, patients who will say, yesterday I had someone who said to me, here is a small gift for Christmas and I won't write a card because I can't express in a card what I need to say. And you get goosebumps. And somehow I believe at least that those blessings that people give us just come back to help us in some way.
Leah Purcell is with us. Ranjana Srivastava is here as well. And in a moment, you're going to be chatting to Ben Opie, oboist, co-founder and member of the Inventi Ensemble and artistic director of the Peninsula Summer Music Festival. Ben's selected a piece of music for you to listen to next, which you'll get to in just a moment on The Conversation Hour. That's it. beautiful arrangement there of Jupiter. Of course, Holst, the planets, is the composition there. Holst composed that a number of years ago, but that's, to my ear, an unusually sort of brighter and lighter rehearing of that and arrangement of it. And it's arranged by the Inventi Ensemble. Ben Opie is the oboist, co-founder and member of the Inventi Ensemble and also artistic director of the Peninsula Summer Music Festival. And he joins me and Leah and Ranjana in the conversation now this morning. Hello and welcome.
Thank you very much.
Is that an incorrect characterisation by me?
No, I think that's absolutely perfect.
Is that what you were going for?
Yeah, definitely. I think in working with a piece like this, which was originally written for something like 60 or more musicians, when you're reducing it down to five people, I think there's always going to be a bit of a lightness to it when it comes to this.
Can I say I think that works better?
Yeah.
I mean, well, there's always something sort of a bit overwhelming about Holst's symphonic arrangement, you know, the planets and each one. It's very, very big, and I get that. But that's kind of how the cosmos might sound if you were out there.
Yeah, that's
a bit
right.
More sort of fizzing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what when we do these arrangements, I think what we really like to do is not necessarily do a small version or a budget version. It's just a different way of listening to it.
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
When did you join the Inventi?
We formed it back in 2014, so we're still relatively young, about 5 years old.
And why?
It was actually because, in a really basic form, we love music and we just wanted to be making as much music as possible. And that seems to have been the theme that's run through my entire career that's led me to all sorts of different places. So just being able to make as much music as possible. And my co-director, Melissa Dakey, we just sat down one day and said, we're not making enough music. We need to make more music.
And when we were chatting outside, you were saying that apart from being the artistic director, you also do some teaching and you teach budding musicians about entrepreneurship. And it struck me that that's something particularly important because it's so hard to make a living as a musician.
It's true.
So what do you teach them? How do budding musicians sell themselves and so on?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's different for everybody. I really do. And I think that's what I try to encourage people to work out what they want to do. And I remember when I was living in Germany and studying, you'd be sitting in a basement somewhere and furiously practicing these scales and you know, knowing that it was for a purpose, but maybe not quite knowing where it was going to take you. At the time, I thought it was going to take me into an orchestra, and that's where I'd stay for the rest of my life, potentially. And then since then, having a job like the artistic director of the Peninsula Summer Music Festival, where I find myself going down to the Peninsula Hot Springs to scout out some locations to find out whether we can do an opera gala there. And sure enough, we will.
Hot Springs would be a nice location.
And then, you know, another day finding myself in Turkey on the Syrian border doing workshops with children, with Syrian refugees, creating instruments made out of junk, and then doing a workshop here. So I think The main thing is finding out what drives people musically and then embracing that as much as possible. And that could absolutely be being in an orchestra, you know.
What was your first encounter with playing music? Was your first instrument the oboe?
No, my mum was a junior primary school music teacher.
Okay.
So I think singing was probably the first thing. Haven't done that in a very, very long time though. And then since then, piano and recorder, and then it was high school, that's when I took up the oboe. So with the oboe especially, it's kind of the weight of it and the physical requirements of playing the oboe mean that we need to start it a little bit later than some others.
Is it really heavy, the oboe?
It's heavy enough that I think any younger and you might just start getting some
That's
injuries.
Why they get you on the recorder.
Yeah, that's right.
Am I going to offend people by saying it's the most annoying instrument going around?
Only when played badly.
I know this isn't a parenting session, but maybe you can be of help. So this whole aspect, this whole idea, and we've been discussing this at home, I have three young children, where they want to try a different instrument every few months. Mm-hmm. And it's expensive, and I think it's a bit of a waste of resources if they don't stick to something. What's your sort of view on how one should deal with this?
Yeah, I think part of the learning in music as well is diligence and patience. And so I would encourage people to encourage their children to stick with it. And there are ways, you know, to encourage that kind of patience and diligence, and hopefully with the teachers encouraging them to have specific goals that they can work towards. I think that's a big part of development in music.
Oh, that's great, because my grandson is 8 and he's just been asked to join his school's band. Mm-hmm. And we said, what instrument would you like? He said, the trumpet, Nan, the trumpet. And I went, fabulous. And he said, and then his mother said, are you sure? It's got viola here. And he goes, well, I actually want the big one that you put between your legs and you go like that. So he's doing the actions of the cello.
Yes.
And we're going, fabulous. Yes, let's do the cello. Yeah. So, but that's a good thing, patience. I must remember that.
Although I kind of like that idea. Isn't there something instinctively interesting going on in the minds of Rajana's kids where they're wanting to try this and try that and try that? I get that it's
I've branded
expensive.
It as spoiled.
All right, there might be that too. But I don't know. Isn't there a musical curiosity going on there?
Absolutely, which is also something to embrace, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember back in when I was playing in high school bands and orchestras, part of the fun of it as well is swapping instruments every now and then.
Yeah.
You wouldn't necessarily tell your teacher that you were doing that. But I think embracing that curiosity is great as well, because you might find one day you found your instrument.
Yeah.
I remember for me, I was always meant to learn the clarinet. There was a clarinet in the family. We didn't want to necessarily have to hire an instrument. And then when it came to the oboe, my hand just shot up and I sort of thought, oh, no, that's the one. That's the instrument for me. So I think, you know, yes, patience and diligence, but also that curiosity.
Experimenting,
yeah,
yeah.
That's right.
It means also, doesn't it, that if you decide the oboe is going to be your musical life, you are committed to playing in ensemble and in group. There's not a great deal, is there? I may be wrong. A great deal of solo oboe music.
Yeah,
out there.
I mean, I've been battling for the last 5 years or so to change that a little bit.
Have you?
Yeah,
okay.
Because I do love it, and I think it's got a very unique voice as a solo instrument as well.
Right.
And there are some champions out there who are working with me, I think, to to bring
oboe champions come out of.
That's true. They're there. Trust me.
They must be there somewhere. Do you play anything, Leah?
I'm a bit of a rhythm guitarist, and I can have a little crack at a bass. I had a band, did the pub scene in Sydney there before, you know, that all went to the pokies. So I do appreciate music, and my mother could sing, and sisters were great singers, and I've got an aunt that was played guitar and wrote her own music, and so yeah, I you know, appreciate the sound and just the calmness and the security it can also give you, you know, when you pick up an instrument and knock out a tune.
Yeah, I feel a collaboration coming on. Bass guitar and oboe. Yeah.
I love that idea. Well, I guess you've probably got the score already settled for the Drover's Dog. The Drover's Wife, the movie. Have you?
Yes, yeah, I have.
We've Who's got doing
a,
that?
A lovely lady called Saliana Campbell from Brisbane.
Okay.
And she has done a lot of theatre, so it's her first film. But when I put the word out, I had a friend who's a bit more on the scene, and her name came back, and I gave them the briefest of briefs so that I wanted to see what they'd come up with. And
what was that?
Just,
what was that brief?
Oh, well, I was listening to a band from Perth, Killing Devil's Hill, and they're a bit bluegrassy. And I just sort of said, it's something in that, but I want it to be earthed. I want edge. And then I, you know, but every now and then, take me somewhere. And she just came back with something, and I said, that's it. I dreamt that. Oh, I could feel that.
Wow.
And I played it to, we've got a wonderful time-lapse artist whose picture it is that's on the cover, and he had a clip of a mist rolling in. And I put this music to that, and I went, that's how we open the film. So it was one of those things. So I thought, no, she's the lady. You know, she's the one.
It's all just working together. Is there much collaboration by the Inventi Ensemble with other groups or creatives?
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of as much as possible. We try to be quite versatile, even for the performance in the Festival of the Planets. We commissioned Johannes Lubers, a Melbourne-based composer, to write 5 new planets, new pieces to be partnered with the 5 that we chose for that piece. So we like to commission new works as much as possible. And then even with that show as well, we worked with a digital artist who created a 60-minute projection of his interpretation of what the music meant, and kind of attached it to the planets themselves as well. So you're sort of teaming with that theme. But yeah, it's quite exciting. I think that's something that's so wonderful about being in the arts and being in a position like I'm in, where we get to create spaces for people to make new things or to celebrate old things, I think. And that's kind of what the festival's about as well, just making as much room as possible for people to explore their expression of music and creativity.
Mm.
And in the Australian summer, when there are so many wonderful distractions to be had, is it difficult to attract an audience?
You'd be surprised. I think there's lots of people already on the peninsula because it's summer, and so they're enjoying the beautiful landscapes and beaches down there. And then having that opportunity to just go along to a 60-minute performance somewhere, and there's a lot of outdoor events as well. And like I say, the Peninsula Hot Springs, you can immerse yourself there. And
I've driven past them from time to time, but I've never organised myself to go there.
Here's your opportunity.
It's also on my list of things to do.
Yeah, that's long, long list.
Performers at the hot springs.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
so there's
yeah, naked in
ones.
Hot water, holding their instruments. <up there.
laughs> you never know.
Sounds amazing.
It's right what you say though about how summer in Australian cities has changed a great deal. The Sydney Festival is always held over summer, mm-hmm. and between what you might traditionally consider those dead weeks between Christmas and New Year and beyond, and instead, no, the city is full. And same in Melbourne now too. There is no dead time, and there's major new productions opening over that period, and the restaurants will be full, and the city will be full, and the gardens will be full, as well as the Bayside beaches. Yep. So life has changed, I guess. Maybe not because we're embracing more of the arts, but just there's more people here. Mm. We're just living more intensely, and there's more of us.
Yep, more to do, which is wonderful. Mm. Yeah. The celebration, yeah.
So what does the next few months hold for you after the Peninsula Summer Music Festival?
After the festival, I go straight into more rehearsals with Inventi. We've got a whole range of things happening next year, including a new project at Federation Square, which is going to be kind of an open concert for people to come along and have an experience, a relaxed performance, so you can bring your kids. Mm. We're talking with Scope Australia so that they can bring some of their disabled clients along and experience a normal chamber music concert, but just in a relaxed environment. And then I head over to Adelaide for the Adelaide Festival, working with Ludovico's band and Marshall Maguire. And then the year is just going to keep on rolling, and I'm sure that the next festival will be upon me.
It will.
Before we know it.
Yeah, we'll be talking about the 2021 Summer Festival, exactly. Leah, would you ever consider going back into performance and music? Would you get the band back together, as they say?
Music is so hard to make a living out of in this country, and that's why I sort of pull the brakes on it. I always wanted to be an actor. I always wanted to direct. We always sung around the house. There's a photo of me with guitar when I'm 5 years old singing a blues version of Humpty Dumpty. but, you know, and when the crunch time came to make a decision, and when you've got a band, the boys were going, what are we doing? What are we doing? And fans were becoming aggressive, saying, I can't get your music anywhere. And I said, look, I'm really serious about my acting and directing, so I've got to let something go. And when you've got other people's lives that you're responsible for, getting gigs and so forth. But we had a great time. My big claim to fame was we supported Shania Twain when she was number one in the world. Yeah, it was unreal. And look, no one goes to watch the support act. We know that.
Yes,
we didn't care.
You're there.
Yeah, we didn't care. We were on the stage. There was 10,000, 12,000 people coming in when we got up there. She had Bruce Springsteen's boys. They just came off mixing for him. And they were bopping to our music. And I said, mate, we're doing all right. So it was more of a hobby, you know. And but, you know, for those who can make it a career in this country, you know, all the power to you. And we should be supporting our local music a lot more. So it's great to have
It's pretty lively here in Melbourne and Victoria, I have to
say. Yes, thank goodness.
There's something you can go to every single night of the week. I always feel like there's a big party going on that I'm left out of, you know. Oh, what, you're playing when? Oh, did you? I didn't know that. All this stuff that I just didn't know, even, you know, sitting in this chair and getting to talk to you people. Hey, Wentworth is coming to an end.
Yes.
That marvellous TV show.
Yeah, it's a shame. I've 6, 7 and 8, I come back down in the new year to join the Series 8 that's filming at the moment. But, you know, who knows? It might come back, but I think they're pretty adamant, take it out on a high, and, you know, there's such a big following around the world. It's amazing, the followers. And I have a ball when we're on the show.
You're right, though, about maybe. Who knows?
Yeah.
Because it was supposed to have gone the first time around.
Yeah.
And as you know, and I'm sure many people know, it went into cult syndication in the United States. And I think still is the original. Yeah.
Yeah.
And but this new iteration of Wentworth, that's playing in the US now as well, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep, all the latest stuff. And it's great that an Australian show women's stories are reaching the world. And like I had a book signing in Sydney and two young gentlemen walked in. I said, oh, this is great. And they were Wentworth fans and I signed some stuff. But they bought a book and they went, you know, thank you. And so it's great. You know, I'm introducing them to other stories and other parts.
Do you feel, and both Ben and Leah, do you feel that success in an overseas market elevates your value here, or is there intrinsic? There should really be, in my mind, an intrinsic value to your work. Yeah. If it makes it overseas, that's brilliant, yeah. And that should be an extra bonus. But often you hear that if something has done well overseas, especially in an American market, then it's almost as if we begin to attach more credibility to it. Is that just me, or is that?
If we're in my gang. It's true. It's a shame that we don't support, you know, and back our artists. That's what we don't do here. We don't back our artists.
But we back them when someone else backs them.
When you go, you've got to leave the country to get success, and then you come back.
Do you think it's still the case?
Yeah.
I get the sense there that creative people who are doing great work here now, that they get recognised here and they get
loved. For me, in the acting stuff and film, you do well at an international film festival, then people... bums on seats, you know.
Ben, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I think, I mean, for me personally, I remember when I was younger, it was everything for me to be able to say I've made it overseas. And I think these days more and more, even with the artists that I've been working with for the festival and with Inventi projects, I think, like you're saying, there is an intrinsic success in the integrity of their work, and maybe it's just more the way that I've shifted my thinking on it to be more focused on, I guess, local artists and supporting those local artists. Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's clear local intention in your work, Leah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm not worried about running over and trying to be a big star in America.
We don't need to listen to the drovers.
The drivers. But you know, it is interesting that sometimes you do have to have people outside the country loving it, and then all of a sudden, you become this. You know, people go, where you been? I'm going, well, I've been here.
Working really hard,
hustling.
Thanks for noticing.
No.
Lovely to have everyone here. The beautiful novel, The Legend of Molly Johnson, The Drover's Wife, written by Leah Purcell, is out in your bookstores now. And the movie version of that will be released maybe late next year.
Yeah, late next year, early 2021.
And the Inventi Ensemble performing the work The Planets by Gustav Holst as part of the Peninsula Summer Music Festival. And Dr. Ranjana Srivastava is my co-host. Her most recent book is A Better Death, Conversations About the Art of Living and Dying Well. And we're all going to go away and organise death over dinner, correct, with our loved ones and talk about how to end our life well, correct?
Live our life well.
Live our life well. It's the only way you'll end it well. As well. Great to have your company today. Thanks for being with me. I'm back tomorrow at 8:30 on ABC Radio Melbourne. Until then, go well.
On ABC Radio, this is The Conversation Hour.